Zai.
What's she doing here? I whispered to Lady Michaela in a near panic.
She's going to be your sister, Tia.
I don't want her to.
What's done is done, Tia,
Mistress Parmina said sharply.
I would expect more courtesy from a novice of the Valerian.
I swallowed hard but kept my silence. Zoya sank into the empty spot beside the old woman.
If it makes you feel any better,
she hissed under her breath, low enough for me to hear.
I would rather scald myself with hot water than be here, had I a choice.
It was an awkward session. A generous amount of runeberry wine was poured into each of our bowls, which we sipped from time to time. The whole purpose of this ritual was for my new sisters and I to get to know each other, and for me to listen to any advice they doled out. Polaire took up most of the conversation, chattering cheerfully away, with Lady Michaela and Alfie chiming in. Rahim was never the type to stay quiet for long, and soon he was regaling us with tales of his home in Tresea. Zoya refused to talk, more interested in her bowl than in any of us. When Lady Shadi rose to her feet, though, Zoya's head snapped forward in the pretty Asha's direction.
I've stayed for as long as I'm able to,
the pretty Asha said regretfully.
Sir Ballard and his family requested for me at the Green Bough.
That's all right, then.
Not even a Kaharde could interfere with Mistress Parmina's desire for money.
You go ahead and tell Chester Ballard that I send him greetings.
Yes, Mother. I'll see you all back home. Congratulations again, Tia.
Lady Shadi left amid a chorus of goodbyes. Zoya watched her leave, then reached for her bowl, drained her wine, and set it back down with a noisy thump.
Well then,
she said with a small snort,
let's get this over with. What exactly is the kind of advice you seek from your betters, novice? It would be best to teach them how not to get into trouble, Zoya.
Mistress Parmina may have chosen her to be my sister, but Polaire was just as much opposed to it as I was.
Did she not benefit from our little accident at the Falling Leaf? And I've heard stories of you as a novice, Lady Polaire. You are the last person to tell me to stay out of trouble.
Zoya looked at me and smirked.
It looks like I am saddled with you, novice.
What other mischief shall we get into,
Surely not the mischief you had planned when you summoned Tia to the Falling Leaf when her novitiate had yet to begin.
Alfie murmured.
Has the little girl been telling lies so early into her apprenticeship? I summoned no one to the Falling Leaf that night. If she chooses to sneak out and explore the willows on her own time, it would not do to have her blaming others for her trouble. And imagine, in no time at all, you shall take Lady Michaela's place, putting Deva back into the ground, sapping away inches of your life with every summon.
Zoya!
Mistress Parmina said, and the girl shut up. For the rest of the evening, she sulked, nursing her wine, and stared at Lady Shadi's empty seat.
I had always thought Asha were sorted according to the elemental magic they wielded. There would be Fire Asha and Water Asha, who would specialize in fire and water magic, respectively. Books called Taki of the Silk a Fire Asha, because she had set fire to the beard of a man who had insulted her in King Maris's royal court at Highgard, for example. But that wasn't the case at all. Most Asha are well-versed in different kinds of elemental magic, so to call one a Wind Asha would be misleading, for they can use earth and water and fire and wood magic just as well. The girl was hard at work, emptying the contents of the cauldrons, now that she had taken samples of each in her files. The Tauravi drew close, prodded at one of the discarded pots with a clawed paw, and shuddered. There were Asha who could dance and sing, but whose command of the runes were minimal enough that they would be useless in a real fight. Lady Shadi fell into this category. I don't think anyone would have expected her to go out and do battle. They often earned the most money for their Ashika, and they are the most likely to have patrons outside of the Willows who would further finance their careers in the arts. It's not unusual for them to wind up being wives of powerful rulers and noblemen. This ensured that those in power would always look favorably on Asha. There were Asha who were known for their expertise in battle rather than on stage. Alfi was this type. She could wield the runes with ease, and I have seen her win a match against 3 Death Seekers at once. What few people know of are the Asha who are highly skilled in politics, in management. They often wind up managing their own Ashaka, and they have the most influence. Mistress Parmina is one, and, though she would never admit it, so is Polair. And then there are those who can sense magic, though not enough to command them. They often become ateliers and apothecaries and hairdressers instead, easily discernible by their purple hearts. Dark Asha are the grunts of the system. We do the most important work, raising and banishing Deva, but we rarely receive a claim for it. We are more likely to be known for our mistakes than our successes. Lady Michaela had summoned and put down Deva for the greater part of a decade, and yet she will always be known as the bone witch who had bespelled a king, one who had her heart taken as punishment. She upended the last of the large pots. We watched it mix with the waves, the seawater diluting its colors, until we could no longer distinguish it from the rest of the surf. "And then there's me," she added.
19. Life after my Kahar day changed. Aside from my usual lessons, I was now obliged to attend some of the parties the Asha went to at least twice or thrice a week, which gave me even less time to myself. I didn't see Fox as often, and I grew to rely on his steady presence in my mind, because it was better than nothing at all. I was encouraged by Lady Michaela to call her and the others sister, although my dislike for Zoya prevented me from ever saying this to her face. I was also encouraged to call Mistress Parmina mother, but I found that equally difficult and never did so unless she prompted me to. Although I could not draw other kinds of runes, Lady Hami began to teach me the combat stances Asha used. I had to recognize and understand the movements they made when they drew in their magic, even though I couldn't use them.
"Tell me everything you know about runes,"
she demanded as I stood shivering in the cold. We were outside Ankyo, in an open field used for runic training, to minimize the injuries and damages that came with the territory. I was clad only in a short tunic and very thin pants my instructor called a serwal, which did nothing to keep out the chill of the morning. Lady Hami was dressed no better than I was, but ignored the morning cold.
"There are 3,000 characters in the runic language," I narrated, my teeth chattering. "But only 500 runes of the old language are known today. Of these, only 200 runes are used for magic. No one yet knows how to make use of the other 300. There are 10 words associated with meditation and healing. 30 for fire magic, 35 for water, 37 for wind, 29 for wood, 31 for earth, 25 for metal, and 3 for dark magic. The more complicated the rune drawn, the more powerful a spell it can—"
"That's enough. You've been paying attention to your lessons, but theory is useless without practical applications."
With one finger, Lady Hami sketched out the rune for wither in the air, an aspect of wood magic. It was roughly the size of her head, and it dissolved easily as soon as she directed her will downward. The grass around us started to decay. It spread out like a disease, until we stood in a brown circle roughly a yard across.
"Now spot the difference."
Lady Hami flung her arms out above her as high as she could, and then brought them back down. She drew the wither rune in this manner, so that this time, the symbol was as large as she was, shining a bright, sickly green light. The circle of decay around us spread farther, 5 times the size of the original.
"The bigger you draw the rune, the more damage it can cause," she said. "You would expect, then, that bigger runes are always better when in battle, yes?" but that is not always the case. She whipped out an arm, punching at the air for a few seconds, and three small holes popped up, one after the other, alongside the large decayed circle, so that from above, it resembled a dog's paw. Or perhaps this. She gestured, this time drawing the wrought rune, and the circle around us sank to a lower level than the rest of the ground. She sketched out rot and mud next, weaving both runes together, and a large patch of land beside me turned into sticky quicksand. She did it again, rushing her movement so that the runes were poorly drawn, like bad handwriting. Another area of the ground roughly the same size as the quicksand appeared, more solid than the first, a fact Lady Hami demonstrated by deliberately stepping onto it. Her boot sank an inch or two but went no deeper.
There is no point in drawing so large a rune when someone could get off three smaller runes and incapacitate you before you can complete the spell. But there is no point in attacking with three smaller runes if they do little damage, and allow your opponent to finish. There is also no point in writing your runes poorly, as slovenly written runes to make quicksand will not make it quicksand. Some runes do more damage but take longer to create. Every fight is unique. There is no blueprint for opponents, and you must learn to decide quickly in the course of a battle, or you will be dead.
But I can't do any of these.
On the contrary, you know three dark runes and then 10 more.
I stared at her. But those runes are for healing and for meditation. I don't know how...
Ah, so now you know better than I which runes to use in a fight, little chitterling? You have suddenly mastered the craft after only half a lesson?
I clamped my mouth shut and shook my head.
Support magic is almost always forgotten when one refers to spellbinding. It can be just as deadly as combat magic if you know how. There is a reason why Instructor Ka teaches you these exercises. Many people do not remember that while Dark Asha cannot use the more popular elemental magic, they can still invoke support magic as well as their own runes. That is why ateliers and hairdressers, who cannot use fire runes or water runes, can use potions and weave support spells into their fashion. Only a rare few know how to turn this into offensive magic. And that is what you are here for. Attack me.
I was at the fourth tier in my combat training, still at the second lowest level, but was competent enough to be further along than many apprentices who started at the same time I did. But I hesitated. Lady Hami's fingers moved, and I was down on the ground. My mind had been suddenly overwhelmed by unexpected and irrational fright.
You were afraid, weren't you?
Lady Hami extended her hand, helped me to my feet.
See what a little support spell can do? Attack me again.
Her fingers moved, and immediately I was overcome by anger. I rushed at the Asha but was stopped in my tracks by a sudden barrage of doubt. What was I doing?
You can use emotions to win a fight without taking a step, Lady Hami said,
and both the anger and doubt disappeared.
The first thing an Asha is taught is how to recognize emotions that are outside of their own and nullify them before they take over. Veteran Asha will not be affected by these spells, unless you are subtle enough that it passes beneath their notice.
She held out the Heart Forger's protection stone that I had entrusted to her before the practice began.
You have an advantage, but you cannot always rely on this stone to protect you. I will first teach you how to defend these attacks. In time, I will teach you more. And perhaps I will even teach your brother, so that he needs not hide behind trees to watch his sister at practice.
There was an injured silence from a cluster of oak trees a few meters away, before Fox walked out.
I felt her distress,
he said. Like this alone was reason enough for his presence.
Yes, you do. And that is why you will accompany Tia from now on to most of her training unless I say otherwise. It would be a waste of time to teach you both separately.
If that is an offer, Lady Hami, I am honored.
It is not an offer,
the woman told him.
It is an order. You are Tia's familiar,
and it will do you both good to learn to control your emotions together. If Tia is to profit from her training, then it is important that you learn the same things she does. But not today. You are not fully her familiar yet, and there are certain requirements that must be in place before I accept you as another student. For now, you will watch, and you will learn when the time comes.
I was grateful when Mistress Parmina decided to end my singing lessons. I had improved to the point where I no longer sounded like a dying frog and could pass off a reasonable warble. But both she and Instructor Tetti decided that to give me more lessons was a waste of time. I would never be asked to sing in any official capacity. This was not a blow to the Valerian's honor, though it was certainly a disappointment. Lady Shadi, for instance, excelled in singing, dancing, and all the refined arts, but was only an average student in combat training. Her movements were too refined, without the quickness and speed necessary to make her effective. The dissolving of my singing lessons gave me more time to pursue my combat lessons with Lady Hami, and I admit that I enjoyed those lessons more, though I frequently lost. My dancing classes continued, where I made better progress. I loved to dance, and I loved my fighting classes. They were compatible skills. I breezed through many of the easier songs and learned 2 new dances a week on average. I was soon promoted to the 4th tier of dance. The same week I was also promoted to the 3rd tier in my combat lessons. Instructor Yasmin and Lady Hami were pleased. So I supposed Mistress Parmina was too. Matches became part of my regular schedule. I sparred every day as often as I could. The week after I received my 3rd tier, I walked into the training hall, still basking in my accomplishment. It was early enough in the day that there were few students about, but I saw Lord Kaelin was present, already geared up for sparring. My steps faltered.
"What are you waiting for, Tia?"
Lady Hami called out, and I hurried to comply. Kaelin frowned when he saw me approach.
"I suppose there's a reason she's here."
"Tia is one of my most promising students, Kaelin. Her training is going splendidly."
"I find that hard to believe."
"Would you like to see for yourself? Tia, stand at the ready."
The instructor tossed me a wooden stick. I caught it.
"Against him? But, Lady Hami, I'm only a student. I haven't even warmed up."
"Only a student, yes. But if you participate only in fights where your opponent is either evenly matched or weaker, or where you have been sufficiently warmed up, then you have already lost. Stand at the ready, Tia."
I obeyed. Kaelin stood on the other end of the mat, flexing his fingers. A few other pupils drew nearer, attracted to the discrepancies in our skill.
"Begin,"
Lady Hami said. And any hope I'd had that the Death Seeker would go easy on me was dashed when he sprung forward, striking a blow to my shoulder before I had a chance to gather my wits.
"Point to Lord Kaelin,"
my instructor said.
"Begin."
Kaelin leaped again, but I managed to counter his next attack. The wooden stick whirled and blurred, and it took all my concentration to keep him from striking another hit. For the next 10 minutes, it was a one-sided affair where he kept up the offense, until he scored another blow to my leg.
"Point to Lord Kaelin. Begin."
"His blows are weaker when they come from his right side,"
Fox's voice said from inside my head, and I nearly tripped.
"Use the room to your advantage. Circle him from your left and wait for an opening."
I followed his instructions and dodged to the left. He spun to confront me.
"Now!"
I dropped to my knees, and the stick flew above my head. I struck out at the same time and managed a glancing blow off his hip.
"Point to Tia. Begin."
"No,"
Kaelin interrupted.
"I'm satisfied with her progress."
He looked down at me, still sitting on the mat and struggling for breath.
"You're pretty good,"
he said, placing his hand on his side and wincing.
"As much as it pains me to admit it."
"Thank you, my lord. I spotted Fox strolling aimlessly along the side of the room, grinning.
I was hoping you would be so kind as to help me train Tia,
Lady Hami told Kaelin.
I think you have much to show her.
I'm not sure I would have the time to—
You said only yesterday that your post here at Onkyo hasn't given you much to do,
the woman pointed out.
And you offered to help me instruct some of my students.
The colors in Kaelin's heart's glass flickered.
I did say that.
Excellent. Lady Hami was brisk. Tia here takes her lessons in the afternoon. I think between us, she will be quite proficient.
Kaelin turned to me with a brittle smile, and I stopped myself from outwardly flinching.
I think so too.
Lord Kaelin poured his resentment into our training sessions and made Lady Hami's seem like child's play by comparison. I frequently came home bruised and tired, with little energy for anything else. But I made no protest. He could have used them to justify how I wasn't strong enough for his training, and he would have been wrong. And as hard as he worked me, he was making me better. I started winning more matches against others in my class, sometimes outclassing those above my tier.
Lady Hami still trounced me often, but I was lasting longer with each fight.
I don't know what kind of arrangement had sprung up between Fox and Kaelin, but I walked in on them sparring on several occasions, with Fox holding his own exceedingly well.
Why doesn't he like me but has no problems with you?
I asked my brother once in a burst of frustration.
He's fairly protective of the prince and views you as a source of danger to him,
Fox pointed out, carefully wrapping his hands in thick strips of gauze.
And there's an advantage to teaching you, even if he doesn't want to. On the off chance that you're with the prince when something attacks, you'd be more adept at fighting them off and protecting him. I reckon it's also why he's sparring with me.
But I don't want him angry with me.
You've got a choice, Tia. You can choose to distance yourself from the prince and possibly earn Kaelin's friendship, or continue your meetings and retain his bodyguard's ire.
Fox looked at my face and sighed.
I thought so.
I have entertained many people in the course of my short time as an Asha. It is believed that Asha only accepted discerning nobles of exemplary tastes and good standing within the community as patrons. The truth was that many who went to those parties could be just as crass and rude as the next person on the street. Being a noble didn't exempt you from being foolborn. Some of my favorite guests came from humble beginnings. Some of my worst guests came from the highest of positions. Breeding isn't what you were born as. Breeding is what you grow to be. You were born a man of Drifta, Bard. You didn't choose the kingdom of your birth, but you chose to protest against the injustices you did see, even as they drove you out. You are a good man. And as for me? She held out her hands, and the Deva flocked to her, nuzzling at her palms like a newborn puppy fresh from the litter, yearning for its mother. I don't know if I can claim to be good and principled, she said softly. But I know exactly what I need to do.
20. No matter how tired I was and no matter how many bruises I earned during my training, I never turned down the prince's requests to join him for an evening meal at the snow pyre. Sometimes Kaelin accompanied him, though he preferred to remain outside the room, ostensibly to keep guard. My practice sessions with the Death Seeker continued. When not criticizing my techniques and form, he ignored me. His dislike still made me nervous, and I frequently made mistakes I would not have with a different teacher. I never told His Highness about Kaelin's disapproval. It was obvious that Prince Kaunce didn't know.
Is Lord Kaelin always this serious?
I asked him hesitantly one time. He never seems to take any days off,
Kaelin's always kept to himself, even when he was younger, the prince admitted. His childhood wasn't easy. His father, my uncle, is in prison.
My history lessons had glossed over this.
What?
My uncle had ties with many nobles in Odalia who tried to rebel against my father 10 years ago.
Dar's Rebellion. I remembered.
The farmers claimed poor treatment, but some of the gentry used it as fodder to declare war against Odalia. Adeva had attacked the city previously, and many citizens perished. My mother and Kaelin's mother among them.
He paused, then added sadly,
"We all took their losses hard."
"I am so sorry, Your Highness."
There were a few who believed that Dark Asha had somehow conjured the Deva, and that my father conspired with them against his own kingdom. The Duke of Holsrath was one of those ambitious gentry who believed in these lies. There was some evidence to prove he instigated the rebellion, but my father chose imprisonment for him over the hangman's noose. I know Kaelin harbors guilt over his father's actions, and he can be very single-minded when it comes to my safety. He has trained with the sword ever since he was a child, intending to right his father's wrongs. His heart's glass only turned silver recently, not very long after first meeting with you and Neve, in fact. But he has continued to remain devoted to my family. I trust him like a brother.
And what about your older brother, Kalat? If you don't mind my asking, I added quickly, worried that I was being too inquisitive.
Most people pretend that my older brother doesn't exist. It's refreshing for someone to be upfront about him.
He smiled sadly.
He was supposed to take over the reins of the kingdom after my father. But his heart's glass turned silver 3 years ago. At first, we feared he would be conscripted to the Death Seekers. But much to our surprise, the Heartforger asked to take him in.
As a favor?
No, the Heartforger would never choose anyone out of sympathy. He has never had an assistant. He said he never found the right one. Kalad was very angry about it at first.
He didn't seem angry to me, I said, recalling the smiling, if vague, young man sitting beside the Heartforger.
Kalad always liked helping people. Being king would have suited him well. But he soon realized he could help people just as much in this way. Forging new hearts for the sick, helping people start anew in life. He was very good at it. Except he started using his own memories for ingredients. More than what he ought to. Kalad always liked to test boundaries.
He sighed.
Sometimes I wish I had the silver heart's glass instead of him. Some days I feel like I don't have the right temperament to take the throne.
But you do, I said, driven to his defense. It would be a shame for Odalia not to have you as its king. I stopped, flushing a little because I hadn't intended to sound so passionate. But the prince laughed.
Thank you for your confidence. I have talked many times to Kalad since then, and he has also been supportive. I suppose that's what brothers are for. But I don't think I have to tell you that. You and Fox have had your share of troubles.
I took his death hard, I confessed, still embarrassed by my previous outburst. I knew nothing then of Dark Asha. I thought I had raised him from the dead through sheer force of will alone.
And now he's both an Asha's familiar and a third lieutenant.
I stopped. Third lieutenant? Prince Kantz looked surprised.
Didn't he tell you?
He's in the army?
He's conscripted. But his duty is only to protect you. My father made him a third lieutenant, with financial compensation guaranteed for your family. Sir Fox has been taking part in Keon's military exercises, and has performed admirably enough to be ranked in so short a time.
And how long has this been going on?
Shortly after you became an apprentice. I'm sorry, Lady Tia. I assumed he'd told you.
Don't be, Your Highness. I wasn't mad. Not really. It explained Fox's bruises. His limp. If anything, I felt glad that he wasn't involved in anything shady. But that didn't mean I was going to let him off that easily. I'd never had reason to visit the Ankyun Palace before. But most of the courtiers and servants took one look at my apprentice robe and left me alone. I concentrated on keeping my presence hidden from my brother until the last possible minute. But I soon saw that this wasn't necessary. Fox was distracted, judging from the irritation I could feel coming from him. A large man in a general's uniform passed me, confirming my suspicions. There was a large tattoo of a bird on his neck. He was the same man I had seen in my previous vision of Fox. I peered into an inner courtyard and found him with his arms crossed, staring stonily down at a younger woman dressed like an Asha. I'd come at the tail end of their argument. The woman threw her hands up in disgust and marched away. Fox was too busy watching her leave to notice me. A lover spat?
Tia! What are you doing here?
My brother was wearing a soldier's uniform. Plain tan breeches and a long-sleeved shirt. I pointed at a star insignia on his shoulder, a symbol of his soldier's rank. I could ask you the same question, I countered. He coughed.
I'm getting my official papers at the end of the week. I planned on telling you then.
Was all this your idea?
No. Your mistress Parmina's.
My mouth fell open.
The Odalian army doesn't have the intensive training Kion's does. She wanted to make sure I could protect you if it came down to it.
I'm surprised she paid attention to you long enough to suggest that.
Lady Michaela's doing, I'm sure.
He scanned my face worriedly.
I'm sorry, Tia. I should have told you sooner.
I can't say I'm pleased by all this planning behind my back. But, honestly, I'm relieved. I thought you'd be involved in something illegal.
Thanks.
Make it up to me. Tell me who that girl was. A girlfriend? She knows you're dead, right? He winced.
No, she's not very happy to find a corpse wandering around the castle. She's dead set against them, in fact. That's another reason I agreed to join the army. I may be a corpse like she claims, but I'm not useless.
It was easy for me to forget that my brother was dead. Easy for me to forget that he wouldn't forget it. You're not useless, Fox. And I'll beat up the next Asha to say otherwise.
She's not.
He trailed off and then hugged me.
Thanks, Tia.
He sounded amused for some reason, and I didn't understand why until much later. I had one other patron who frequently requested my presence at parties. Counselor Ludwig of Estera was an old man with a pinched face, prone to going into rants about how things were better in his time, because for many years he served as King Nodvik's most senior political advisor and guided the small Winter Kingdom into a robust economy and into one of its most peaceful eras. He retired a few years ago, but his mind remained as sharp as ever. He had no patience for flattery and always called things the way he saw them, regardless of whose feelings were hurt in the process. I enjoyed conversations with him immensely. When I first met him, he was in a horrible mood. Another round of death seekers from the kingdoms had been dispatched to hunt for the still elusive Savul, and he was opposed to the idea. There were already other Asha in the room when I entered, trying to steer him away from the gravity of the discussion. Other guests were also present, all close friends of Counselor Ludwig and used to his ways.
Do the kings today have nothing but empty space between their ears?
He demanded, ignoring my entrance.
Have they done nothing but be coddled by their mothers for the first 30 years of their lives? To take out most of the death seekers in the kingdoms is tantamount to suicide. They are inviting open conquest of their own kingdoms. If I were a jackanape with a large enough force and a command of the runes, I could conquer Trisea in 3 days, before any word could reach the bulk of your men, Vorkon. A standing army will not last long when there is magic involved.
We are at peacetime, my lord counselor,
one of his friends pointed out.
And there are no standing enmities among the kingdoms. Even your Astera and Trisea have a treaty. And historically, you have always been enemies.
And you are an idiot for letting peacetime lull you into a false sense of security.
Counselor Ludwig raged at him.
Can you not see that there is no need for treaties to one who might be biding their time? Now you're being paranoid, Ludwig.
The first diplomat to the Eidosha city-states rejoined good-humoredly.
No one can control the Deva. That is the point. Not even the Dark Asha can do so. And Lady Tia can attest to. None of the Faceless have been strong enough to do more than... And what enemy would choose to show their strength? It is not enough to fight off attacks as they happen. It is important to predict how and when they occur to prevent them from happening to begin with.
My apologies.
Vorkon, the counselor to Trisea, said to us in a near whisper.
He hasn't always been this angry. He was the most brilliant man I'd ever met as a young man, despite our kingdom's animosity. Quite a mind.
Now, counselor.
A pretty brown-haired Asha named Brindis interjected.
We shouldn't be talking about such serious things at a party. Come, why don't you tell us about the many achievements you have had? It is not every day that we have as our guest of honor one who has forged such a successful path for the kingdom of Astera. King Rindorvik must owe a lot to you.
If only his son had his father's guts.
Counselor Ludwig snorted,
unswayed. Counselor Ludwig! Such a thing to say about your king!
He'll live. I have said worse things to his face.
Oh, let's not worry about such things.
Caddy, one of the other Asha, begged.
It all sounds so frightening to me.
The conversation drifted to other matters, and soon the other politicians began lecturing the Asha on the history of their countries. Our history lessons had included such matters, but we nodded our heads like we have never heard them before. Counselor Ludwig leaned back while the others talked, scowling into his tea. The others were occupied, so I angled closer to him.
What makes you think that some of the kingdoms could be invaded in the near future? I asked.
He started. I don't think he remembered I was even in the room. He eyed me suspiciously at first, but my sincerity must have shown on my face.
Peacetime does not excuse the reality that there are numerous factions out there for blood. For as long as the problem of the Deva exists, the Faceless will use them to breed fear and terror among the people.
What should the kings do instead?
Send all available spies and scouts out to gather intelligence as to the Deva's whereabouts first. Once located, gather all Dark Asha. Well, you and Lady Michaela. Add a few more Asha and Death Seekers for additional firepower. And strike out. To have every able Death Seeker scouring the lands hoping to stumble into a sovel by accident is a waste of time and ability. It doesn't matter that the people clamor for a show of force. Pomp and fanfare for so few results will not help defend a kingdom. Only expose its weaknesses to the unseen enemy.
That sounds logical. But why won't they listen to you? The old man snorted again.
Because they think they know better. Kings nowadays play more to the politics than to any real strategies. Keon is more welcoming when it comes to Dark Asha like you, my dear. But other kingdoms aren't as open-minded. Bone witches passing through their territories does not make kings popular. Death Seekers guarding their borders satisfies their need for security. However false it may be.
I felt disheartened.
I had nurtured the foolish thought that being an official Asha meant that people would be more inclined to look favorably on me. Even if Lady Michaela's reception had been anything but.
Don't worry your pretty head over it, my dear,
the old man said kindly.
You, Dark Asha, have my respect and my trust, and I wish that counted as much as it used to. Tell me more about your lessons. How many runes of the dark have they taught you?
Counselor Ludwig started coming more often to the Chahana after that. Despite my busy workload, I always did my best to spend at least an hour with him. Because he usually only asked for me, our meetings were less of a party and more like my lessons. He instructed me on politics, geography, and military history, and taught me more about strategy than any instructor I had.
But why can't you flush out all the other faceless? I asked him at one time. If you know where their strongholds are, shouldn't it be only a matter of time?
It's not as easy as that,
Counselor Ludwig said.
It's easy to imagine them concentrated within one small area, instead of being dispersed over a population of people who have little idea of whom they are truly fraternizing with. They do not build their defenses with high walls and fortifications, Tia. Even Druge conceals his fortress well in his mountains, and it would be difficult to lay siege. As for Ena and Usij, they build their defenses with a population of innocents for a shield, which is a considerably more difficult hurdle to overcome. It took us 20 years to cobble together a comprehensive report to capture Ena's men, and still that witch escapes us. I have always advocated for King Rendorvik to train more spies. He acquiesced occasionally, though he always considered it a dishonorable trait. Dishonorable!
Counselor Ludwig snorted.
There is no dishonor to winning a war.
Once or twice a month, the Heartforger's assistant would ask for my presence at the Snowpyre. A Dark Asha's heart's glass was in high demand, and many ingredients could be gleaned from its depths. The old Heartforger himself, the boy said, was frequently away on trips. His services were constantly sought after even outside of Kion. I was willing to provide what his assistant needed, but I also felt awkward around him. Now that I knew his true identity, I didn't know what name to refer him by. I could no longer call him by his royal honorific, so should I call him Lord Kalad instead? Or Junior, as the Heartforger had called him?
Kalad will do,
he said calmly.
The Forger calls me Junior as a means to distance myself from the royal house. But sometimes I think I need to remember who I was to have an idea of who I should be.
How did you... Kalad smiled, nodded at my heart glass.
You, Asha, do not have the monopoly on reading them.
But not to that degree of specificity.
You mean you can't do that?
He sounded surprised.
My master said I was unusually perceptive, but I always assumed it wasn't uncommon. Take a deep breath.
He touched my heart's glass and I felt a quick twinge, like someone had pricked me with a tiny needle made from ice. The gaping mouth grinned malice at me. From within the depths of those empty eye sockets, something glinted. The skeleton gave me no time to recover, but lunged. When he took his hand away, I saw a wispy thread of smoke winding around his knuckles, disappearing into his own heart's glass when he pressed his fingers against it. I was shaking. For a moment, it felt real, like I was confronting the skeleton all over again.
Thank you. True fear is harder to find than you might think,
he said conversationally, patting my hand.
I visit the army for most of that.
He'd pulled a lot of memories from me these last few months. Memories of seeing my brother rise up from the grave. Memories of Lady Michaela summoning the Tarvi. Memories of meeting the Oracle. You've never asked me about them.
About what?
About the skeleton?
Or my brother, or the Taurvi? You see my memories as well as I can every time you take them out.
I do. But your memories are only important to me in forging hearts. Their importance to you is your own business, and no one else's. I do not ask, and I share them with no one else.
He flexed his fingers.
I'll need one more, and then that's enough for today.
You impose limitations on how many you can draw from me, but you don't do the same for yourself. He smiled sheepishly.
Too many hearts, not enough memories. Master says I overexert myself, but maybe it's for the better. I have something of a temper. This will only take it.
From inside his hood, the boy's face hardened.
Your kind killed my mother!
He snapped. He turned and fled back into the confines of the crowd, but not before his heavy cloak shifted and I saw his... Khalad stopped. He leaned back.
Well, he said.
Is something wrong? I asked nervously.
Nothing's wrong.
He rose and bowed to me.
I think I have all that I need. Thank you again, Lady Tia.
It was only after he left that I realized he had not taken my memories of the boy in the hooded cloak.
Everyone is believed to have two faces. One they show to the public, and one they wear in private. The first face is their shakzayat, or their honor. The second face is their eterim, their dignity. It is a concept practiced more commonly in Odalia, but also adopted by the Ashaka and Ankyo. It is important for a person to interact with others in such a way as to embrace their shakzayat, while still maintaining their eterim, to increase others' estimation of them while remaining true to one's self. It is harder than it sounds. Many actions that elevate people's opinion of you are not necessarily what you truly wish to do. It is a matter of balancing both faces so you can do what is expected of you and at the same time pursue your personal goals.
I did not fare very well with my shakzayat then, I said, bitter. Our meal that night was composed of Odalian delicacies, fried rice soaked in saffron and caramel, called tadig, kebab kubida, flavored with turmeric and set on sticks hewn from mere driftwood, and doog, a flavored sour yogurt. I had not seen her prepare the meals, did not think she was capable of cooking them in such a short time. You considered your dignity to be greater than what the royal courts demanded of you. And this imbalance is the reason why they cast you out of Dricht. In the same way, I considered my dignity to be more important than the rules and restrictions that clog the traditions of the Willows, and that is why I find myself in the Sea of Skulls, foraging for bones. But would you do it again, given the chance? Would you sacrifice your shakzayat to retain your eterim? Yes, I said, without hesitation. She smiled at me. Then we are not so different after all.
21. My Asha sister Alticia was a lot like my sister Rose. She was round and quiet and keen on gardening. She was also Ankyo's foremost expert on herbs and medicine, and was a consultant to many apothecaries operating in Ankyo. She made the best dizi I had ever tasted. And her gourma sabsi could silence even Polaire. Unsurprisingly, her ingredients were always fresh, and she was in the know with most of the vendors in the marketplace, so that her roasted lamb, seasoned and cooked for 3 hours to perfection, went unbelievably well with her sautéed kale, chickpeas, and parsley stew, along with anything else she chose to cook. Every other week, I would accompany her on what was a typical morning for my sister Asha. Most people visit the marketplace at dawn to find the choicest seafood and cuts of meat, but much of the preparations took place long before the sun rose. Alticia was hard on vendors who sold rotten food, and it was an easy way to go out of business. Meek and mild-mannered for the most part,
she changed into a no-nonsense, uncompromising taskmaster when it came to food standards. We didn't always visit the Ankyan market. When she brought me to a tall, white building at the edge of the city for the first time, the smell of dirty linen assailed my nose the moment we entered. People dressed in gray frocks rushed past us, carrying an armful of sheets or complicated-looking metal instruments. Patients lay on pallets on the floor, as many as a dozen in every room we passed.
"There is one skill people often overlook in an ASHA,"
she said as she stooped over an old man swaddled in blankets, fast asleep.
"And that is the precision by which we can perceive color. Tell me the color of his heart's glass."
"Green."
"No. It is octarine."
"But isn't octarine just another shade of green?"
"And therein lies the difference. Ailments give very specific tints, Tia. Green only tells me that the illness is a physical one. Hues, heart rhythms, brightness, they show me the specifics of a disease. I will teach you how to observe and keep track of these differences."
"You there, Cecily!"
she snapped at a woman built like a broomstick.
"Didn't I tell you to change the patient's bed sheets every day?"
"But, Lady Alticia, Mistress Mull made it clear that we could only—"
"I don't care what that car has made clear!"
Alfie raged, a veiled tigress. "Tell her that Lady Alticia demands clean sheets and linen for every patient. And if that happens to cut into her profit, then so be it. Perhaps she needs to be reminded one more time of the cow."
The woman paled.
"I will see to it, Lady Alticia."
Many also came to Alfie for ailments that normal physicians and apothecaries could not heal, and they were as complex as they were varied. She taught me to prepare ointments and medicine. I pounded piscilla seeds and ground root for small worm antidotes, or mixed dragon fruit pulp and stingberry juice for high fevers. The variations among the heart's glass colors were difficult to distinguish, and I made many mistakes. But each day I improved. 2 months after we began, Alfie regretfully informed me in the middle of our cooking lesson that she would be leaving. We were preparing chicken fesanjan with yellow rice, which also happened to be Polaire's favorite meal. As was common during these lessons, Alticia would grill me about the kinds of herbs we used.
"You must learn to make this by the end of the day," she explained, "for I will have very little time to teach you when the week is out. Now, do you remember what nuts we topped the stew with?"
"Ground walnuts," I replied, "paired with pomegranate sauce."
"What do you mean, you have very little time?"
"I will be returning to my duties as Princess Inessa's bodyguard in 5 days' time. And so ends my stay in the Willows. What other sicknesses do walnuts treat?"
"Canker sores and bright fever, unless the patient is allergic to nuts. Which means we substitute saffron and twisted barley.
You want to be Princess Inessa's bodyguard?"
It was hard to imagine her as anyone's bodyguard, with her broad face and glasses and the circle motifs in her hua that only emphasized her roundness. It also occurred to me that I have never once seen her fight. Alfie smiled at me.
"I have always been her bodyguard. I merely asked for leave to care for Mickey and oversee your education. I will still be in the city. The castle is a stone's throw away, and the princess has always been accommodating when other Asha come to visit. Besides, you'll have your other sisters here to take care of you."
"But none who cook as well as you do." I was crestfallen. As much as I was fond of her cooking, I was even more fond of Alticia herself. The redhead laughed.
"I am sure there will be more than enough to do here to occupy your time. Now, what are the three illnesses that ingesting apple crut and figberry syrup will help alleviate?"
"Stone fevers, diarrhea, and indigestion. Alfie, when we visited that charity house a while back, you threatened the mistress with a cow."
"Mistress Mal owns that charity house, and she once told me she would pay more for her clean linen when cows fly."
Alfie went back to chopping more onions, and I had to prompt her again. "But you eventually came to an agreement?"
"Only after I punched a new hole in her house.
using one of two wooden cows I had commissioned at the carpenter's. It went through her wall like a plunger through churned butter. I built it to size, so I expected such results.
Althea continued to chop serenely, paying no attention to my shock.
I paid for the wall, of course, but I also paid to have the second cow erected on the field across from her place. Mistress Mal has been getting on in years, but I've found it to be a most effective way to jog her memory. Now, what color would gingivitis look on someone's heart's glass?
When Altesia finally left to take up her duties in the castle, my time was claimed by Polaire. Because of my lessons and my training, the evenings were one of the few times I had for myself. Polaire soon usurped even that. There were two sides to Polaire as well. She scrutinized me as I entered the small tea room at the Gentle Oak. Her lips pursed.
"That's a horrible outfit," she said.
"What?"
I was wearing the prettiest hue I had. It was a deep maroon, with golden butterflies fluttering halfway up its skirt, and a waist wrap of soft beige with outlines of brown leaves embroidered along its edges.
"We're meeting the envoy to Drix, you dummy. He's an old and cranky stick in the mud, and he wouldn't approve of women wearing such bold colors."
She gestured at herself, at her lavender hue with tiny lilies painted in large clumps along the bottom of her gown.
She shook her veil at me.
"Didn't I tell you to do your research? It's a little too late to go back and change. It chafes at delays. Let's see what we can salvage."
She was right. The envoy was a yellow-faced old man with cheeks pulled down like a bulldog's, and he drew back a little when he saw my hue.
"Do Ashaka take in courtesans now?"
he sputtered, scandalized.
"Women were not so bold in my day, least of all Asha apprentices."
His heart's glass actually bristled, the colors palpitating between turgid yellow and green.
"Forgive us, Envoy Mu'awin."
I never knew Polaire could gush so.
"I told Tia here to come in her most outrageous hue, so you can point out all that is wrong with it, to teach her. Who is the authority on all manners of propriety and custom, I asked myself, and thought of you."
"Well,"
the man relaxed, mollified.
Quite clever of you. Unlike some of my countrymen, I am not one to deny progress and women's rights. My views are known to be liberal."
I stared at him in consternation.
"But with all these indecent girls nowadays showing off legs and ankles without so much as family to accompany them, they wind up in all sorts of trouble. It's important to cover up, to prevent men from indecent thoughts. Why, the stories I could tell you, if you knew the shamelessness of such women."
We didn't want to know, but he regaled us with them anyway. Afterward, he told me the 57 things wrong with my Hua, and my dislike for him grew with every justification.
"We're wearing practically the same thing," I hissed at Polaire when Envoy Mu'awin excused himself to go to the bathroom. "How can he find 57 things wrong with mine but not with yours?"
"The Drikta are a conservative people. Most would consider us terribly underdressed, and they avoid the willows altogether. Envoy Mu'awin is a diplomat and a progressive man in comparison. But what you consider similar is to him a world of difference. Red on a female implies that she flouts tradition and is therefore a loose woman. You wear the color on your clothes and in the jewels in your hair. Drikta men prefer that their women dress simply, without any ostentatious gems. Your hua has a slit on your side and exposes a part of your leg, while mine has none. Maybe he just doesn't like the color red."
"That is no excuse, Tia."
Polaire was stern. "Know the people you entertain. If they are offended, you not only bring dishonor to the Valerian, but also to the tea room you stay at and me by association as your sister. Our opinions do not matter. And if you have to swallow your pride to keep them happy, then so be it. Now,
Stop slouching. I can hear him coming back.